Alan Gring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Autumn Semester 2016. Lecture 1, delivered on August 23, 2016. The title of this lecture is Introduction to Finance.
Today, Introduction to Finance. Finance is one of the major fields in business. I do not want in any way to trivialize the other business fields, even though I'm going to say perhaps negative things about them. It's all in jest. So, for example, when I talk, sir, are you an accounting major? Good. Do you know what you get when you cross an accountant with a jumbo jet? A boring 747. Sir, are you a marketing major? Okay, do you know what it takes for a marketing major to get a job? What? We don't know because we haven't seen one get a job lately. Oh, that was harsh. I use these other fields sort of as kicking stones, but at the same time we have to appreciate that business is an integration of all of the different disciplines, and I can say that as a business person myself. There's the accounting that I have to do to make the government happy and all that. There is the marketing I have to do and I have to understand so that I can actually produce and sell my product. There is transportation logistics, the MQM kind of stuff that I have to do to understand the workflow that is involved in this business of mine and in the businesses for which I consulted. Other human resources is an enormously important thing. It's finally being respected, although the pay still isn't so great. But international business is still not well received, but it will get better received in the years ahead as we appreciate the contribution that IB majors can make. But anyway, they're all important. However, they are all distinct. There are some textbooks out there, and there are an awful lot of business people, too many, who think that finance is somehow accounting. There's an executive at an important company here in town who said, well, the people we hire for finance, we expect them to all take the CPA. And I said, what? Why? This finance isn't accounting. In other words, you want accountants. You don't want finance people. You just want accountants. No, we want finance people. Well, that's... Anyway, the point there being that accounting is separate from finance. We use the information resources of accounting when we have to, and we have to quite often. But we also have to appreciate that accounting does not tell us what we need to know in finance. Let's think about this a little bit, how I want to phrase this. Finance is actually a subdiscipline of economics. Finance focuses on the money, the monetary, and unfortunately too much on the business side of economics. But I am a financial economist as well as other things. And so you hear me take on the economics aspect of it. You have to know what happens when supply increases, when demand increases, not for goods and services so much in this class as for securities. What happens when the supply of the security goes up? Well, the price goes down. What happens when the demand for a bond increases? Well, that would mean that the price goes up, but that means that the yield on the bond slides downward. Those kinds of things come from the world of economics. And so economics becomes an important part of finance. Accounting Which is, as a matter of fact, you'll see job postings, finance person wanted, accounting major preferred. Well, that just bunches my boxers, because there is no way that an accountant knows what we know in finance. And let me make sure you understand this. Accounting is important, but it has to have documented records. So let me take you on a couple of journeys here. God, who's a good victim for me on this? Yep, you. A Justin Bieber hair flip? Yes. Okay, you decided to major in finance. And, you know, I'm so proud of you. We've gotten you through the program and helped you to secure a $60,000 a year job at State Barn. You're on your way. There you are at the graduation. I'm sitting there with the other professors in our black robes. We always scowl at you. You are so unworthy of this degree. But inside, we're, oh, there's my boy going off. And there you go. You take off. You disappear into the night. I know you've got a great job and all that. 2 years later, you show up at my office. You've gained a little weight, but, you know, that's normal. And you kind of look a little different, look a little haggard and tired. But, hi, Professor C. Oh, my. You graduated from here. I can't remember your name. Getting old. But, yeah, we got you. You guys did a great job on the interviews. We made some contacts at State Barn, and you got a job there. Well, you must be getting promotions and all that. Well, no. That's not what I did. Huh? I was driving away that day, and it hit me. I have to live my dream. You what? Yes, I opened my own donut shop. Huh? Yeah, I said, to heck with State Barn. I wanted to be a donut shop owner. And so I started my own donut shop. I just got my first year's accounting financial statements back. Full year's accounting financial statements back. And I made a profit of $20,000. What do you think of me, Professor C? And you know what I'm going to say to you? You idiot. You imbecile. You listener to Nickelback and Dubstep. You didn't make $20,000. You lost $40,000. Accounting says you made a profit of $20,000. Well, finance says you blew down 40 grand. Do you understand why that happened? Madam, do you understand why? It's opportunity cost. He gave up $60,000 to make $20,000. Yeah, that's bad news. I'm going to say to you, you go to that donut shop of yours and you burn it to the ground. Well, get the donuts, bring them to me first. Let's not go radical here. The red velvet donuts and those French crullers to die for. But anyway, we can't care about the accounting of it. We have to care about the reality of the hustle and flow of the money going in and the money coming out. Let me show you an example from my own business. And the numbers are pretty much close to one of the works that I've done. Create the artwork. It's the photographic art. Doesn't look like a photograph. Looks more like a painting. And so I get the print done at a high-end professional printing house in New York City. And then I have a professional dry mount, then double mat, then museum quality glass, and a custom frame, mounting brackets. And so I am going to end up having a cost of $300. $300, okay? So, let's say I charge I make $5, don't I? No, I don't. Because as soon as I sell that work, I have to create it again. So in order for me to be able to make it again, I would have to double the price to have $300 after I have replaced the inventory. And then, to make it even more serious, well, that just is the physical parts. It has nothing, that includes nothing for the equipment behind this. $4,000 worth of camera and lenses. The expensive software for processing. And that's not even the end of it. What about me? I spend hours and hours, sometimes in frostbitten hands out in the middle of nowhere to take a shot that some rich lady in Rockford's going to love in her bedroom or something like that. So let's say that I deserve $10 an hour for my work. Well, okay, me, $8 an hour. Okay, I'm going to have to get some compensation for that, for the equipment. And the use of it, the wear and tear on it, the loss that is going to happen when frames or get scratched, glass gets shattered in transit to one of these art festivals, and all of that kind of stuff. Paying promoters who never come through, that whole nine yards. Okay, so when I charge this for that work, I'm not being a greedy bastard. I'm being a survivor in business. That's all I'm being when I do this. But you know what the bad part is? See that $300 that I spent? I can't put that on my financial statements for the accountants as an expense. Because until I sell it, it's inventory. I have to capitalize it. So I got $300, just went away, and there I am, not even being able to recognize that as a cost of my business unless I sell that work. That's why in finance, we can't care about what the accountants have said. We have to look at what we call free cash flow, the actual physical movement of money. Do I have a net positive or a net negative? And that whole idea of profitability. You will see companies post their financials. Oh, this company made $30 million in the last quarter. Isn't that great? Well, the stock price goes through the floor. Why? Because the investor said, for the risk we took in this company's stock, that is not enough. So we're going to sell this off until the price drops enough to make it worth buying again. Because we care in finance about risk versus reward, not just profit. Profit means really not a whole lot to us. Famous story of a turnaround specialist who was appointed the CEO of a major corporation that was in serious financial trouble. And he said to the board of directors and to the executive managers in a meeting, one of his first meetings, folks, I can make this company profitable every year until we go out of business in bankruptcy, which will happen within 5 years. You can make the company look profitable, but it's not that the company will survive, because that means you have to have positive net cash flow. You have to have money coming in, whether or not the accountants say money is coming in or not. And that just has to be the reality of it. So there's one of the reasons that we have to be cautious with financial statements that are produced according to accounting. And that does not mean that the accountants are evil or anything like that. They have to follow rules. They have to have a receipt. Receipts are not something that we need to deal with in finance. So we're going to go on to the next example. You, sir, you were going to this fine university until you took this class from this professor who was yelling and spit came out of a finance professor, and he was degrading people in class and all that. So you said, the heck with this. I don't want to do this anyway. Do you know what you wanted to do? You wanted to run your own little gas station. You know, one of those with a little kiosk, and you sit inside the back room watching a little black and white TV, and you sell cigarettes and help people get their lung cancer started and that kind of stuff. And so you did it. You changed your name to Earl so you could wear a blue shirt with one of those ovals that says Earl, okay? And all the whole nine yards, okay? Good. Well, here's what's going on. Now, you get your gasoline from an independent, and there are a number of stations along the route the independent drives down this little road. And the Cocaline driver comes in and sells you gas at $1.80. It's been that way for a couple of loads. Now you mark it up, and that's per gallon. Now you mark it up 30 cents per gallon so that you have a retail of $2.10, which is the prevailing at the stations all along the road. They're all buying the gas at the same price. And there's no reason for you to try to charge less because you've got as many customers as you want. You all sell out your loads over the week and all that. And you're certainly not going to charge more because people will come to your gas station. Of course, there are some gas stations that try to charge you. We're special. We're BP, so we charge you 5 cents more a gallon. No, it's not. It's gas. You know, light it. It'll blow you up just the same as the gas at the cheapo station will. Okay. Well, here comes the Cocaine driver, and he pulls up to your station. So you come out of your little kiosk, and you hitch up your pants. How you doing, sir? What's the price of gas? And the guy looks at his computer. He says, $1.80. Same as, you know, weeks before. So you take the 10,000 gallons, and you pay him. And he drives on. And you go back in, and he's driving down the road. It's got a little ways to go to the next station. And you go back to your kiosk and sit down. You're watching serious news program, Fox News. And but the TV's showing something completely different from what you saw when you went in there. When you left. When you left, they were talking about something with Kanye and one of those Kardashians, and it was really engaging. But when you go back, you're looking at a screen filled with explosions and a mushroom cloud. And then they switch to a picture of what looks like an aircraft carrier actually sinking in the water. And there's a stream across the bottom. Israel wages nuclear attack on Iran. Suspected nuclear facilities. Iran responds, mining the Gulf of Hormuz. Sunburn missiles have been launched against U.S. aircraft carriers and battleship groups. Two aircraft carriers are known to be sinking, etc. Iran launched Mark IV capability missiles that are targeting right now Rome. War has been declared. The Gulf of Hormuz has been mined. Oil tankers are sinking. Massive oil spills throughout the Gulf of Hormuz spilling into open water in the Indian Ocean. And you look out. Uh-oh. Cocaine driver pulled into the next station, and he has charged that guy $10.50 a gallon. That station owner marked it up 30 cents. And so you have your competitor down the road at 1080 posting. As the next hour goes on, 1080, 1080, 1080 at all the stations along the road. What are you going to do to your price? Leave it? Change it? What are you going to do? Change it to what? He said he's going to change his price to 1080. Greedy son of a bitch. Yeah. Go ahead. I wouldn't do 1079. I can still sell it at 1080. You know, the drivers are going to pay for it. So I don't need to worry about them. They can take the gas or run out of gas and try to hitch a ride from someone else. It ain't going to happen that he's going to keep it at 210. Well, you greedy man, you bought it at $1.80. How could you be that way to those customers of yours? And it actually isn't greed that's driving him, not greed at all. You see, because what's he going to have to pay for his next load? $10.50. So if he sells $1.80 plus 30 cents, he's out of business. He's gone. He's dead. And you know what those customers who bought his gas at 210 are going to do after he's gone? They're going to drive right by that ghost town that was his gas station. They're not even going to remember his name. His name was Earl. But they're just going to drive by because they don't give a rat's ass about him any more than he should give a rat's ass about them. The best he can do for them is to survive in business. That's what we have to do in business. That's our job, is survival. After that, we can do things like contribute to charities. We can talk about Mother Gaia and saving the earth and all that. But the first thing, if we're going to do all of that, we have to live to see the next day and fight there. So if he doesn't bring his gas price up, he is violating one of the most important rules in finance. Historical cost means nothing. Replacement cost means everything. Historical cost, the basis of accounting, doesn't mean much to us. I'm going to take a shot at you, sir. You bought $100 worth of some stock on a recommendation from some moron named Kramer. And now the stock has gone down to $10 in value. I want you to tell me something. You come to me and you say, I want you to tell me. What do I do? And I say, okay, you tell me. What should you do with this $10 stock? Should you hold it? Sell it? Actually, yes. You would be surprised, though, at how many people will say to me, well, I'm going to keep this stock until I recover my investment of $100. No, no, no. That $100 means nothing. You know where that $100 is now? You know where that $100 is? It's with Jesus. It's dead. It's gone. All that you have is $10. Your decision on whether to hold or sell is based upon the prospects of that stock price from where it is now at $10 a share. Nowhere else matters. That $100 is a sunk cost. And this is the sunk cost fallacy. And I saw it as a consultant so many times. There was this small company based in the South, and they had plowed $1.6 million into a project in stage one. And they were about to have to put in another $500,000, about $500,000. And I just said, well, I was a consultant. My job is to sit there and wait for them to give me what they think is the best decision and then make comments on it. I said, well, what are you going to do? You're going to spend the $500,000? The president of that company said, well, we've already put in a $1.6 million. We better keep going. No, 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 that $1.6 million is irrelevant. It is gone forever. It means nothing. All that matters now is whether or not an investment of $500,000 is going to return a sufficient return on investment. Nothing else matters. That $1.6 million drives you crazy. It doesn't matter. Once it's spent, it's gone. And all that matters from here is the future. That's why we have these stock gurus and geniuses always showing you these stock price charts. Well, look at the pattern of that stock price over the last couple of years. Who cares? The stock price tomorrow has nothing to do with the stock price yesterday. All information about the past is already in the price that is sitting there now. History does not matter in the high-powered, high-speed world of finance. You think you've got some information that you're going to trade on? Well, I heard this information a couple of days ago, so I'm going to buy this stock. You're an idiot. Let me tell you how bad it is out there. There is one of the massive major brokerage houses that acquires and acts on information so fast that it is looking into the future. Its current record is about more than 100 milliseconds into the future. If you think that you've got information no one else has from data that you've been analyzing, know this. The globe is 24/7. Clockers are working all the time. The best and brightest minds in the world have streaming computers of information all around them. Computers that can think faster than any human on earth are processing, grinding out, digesting that information, and making the predictions on the stock, making the buy recommendations for securities right now. you can't beat that system. No matter how much you think you're a genius, you try to go up against Goldman Sachs, which can look into the future now. That's science fiction, but it's now happening. And even if Sachs was out of the picture, you still have all of these trading houses that have all of these information resources and all of these extraordinarily best of the best traders and the best of the best computers. You can't beat on historical information. That's why I need you to think critically. Yeah, we crank the numbers. We grind out the old-fashioned stuff. It's based on accounting. But then we go past that and we say, all right, let's think about the company itself. You're not going to gain any special insights on this company by looking, sitting at a computer in a little quiet cubbyhole. You have to walk out there, look at the company, find out about the personalities of the management, find out about its prospects for markets, find out about its competitors. Look beyond the numbers. Don't look around the numbers. Look beyond them. That's why we have to do the numbers so that we can then start making, asking the serious questions that the numbers can't answer for us. There are other issues that are involved here too. The costs that we care about are future expected costs. Now, the historical numbers that are given to us in accounting do provide information, but not just straight out. You have to kind of play with the numbers. We do financial ratios. And then we say, all right, it's not so much the ratios. It's those ratios relative to the industry, relative to the current economic situation, relative to the economy. And then look at the trend in the ratios. How are they moving? So there's a lot to it that goes beyond just producing the numbers. It's producing the numbers, then asking the right questions. Now, taking you on the next part aspect of this, I've talked to you about the historical cost versus replacement cost, sunk cost fallacy. I hinted at opportunity cost, the cost of what you give up to have what you have. I'll tell you a story about this. When I was teaching at another place here in town, I won't mention the name of it. It's at a prestigious elite private university. And again, I won't mention the name of that university here in town because I don't want to offend those people. I was running these big finance classes there. They weren't like these this big, but they had all these finance majors and other business majors. They wanted them to have guest speakers come in. So at that time, some years back, this was when the then mayor of Bloomington had this vision of a convention center, an entertainment center here in Bloomington. This was going to be her legacy. And she wanted to come in and speak to our business students about this incredible plan that was in the works for this entertainment arena thing. So she brought her finance guy with her. She had him on a nice leash. She was a very attractive caller. Come on, boy, here. And then she spoke for a while to us, impressed us. And then she had him come up there and show us the numbers. Now, he went through the building costs and all that kind of stuff. He said, okay, he went through all these building costs. And then he went through and talked about the revenue. He believed that there was going to be Bloomington right here. Oh, who am I kidding? Bloomington right here. And then this giant 60-mile radius of buyers of tickets. Now that right there, really? What's within 60 miles of here? Yeah, the convention center. Oh yeah, you can either have a venue in Peoria or you can have a venue in a place called Normal. Really? Okay, but that was, you know, those pie in the sky assumptions will burn you every time. But he also went through all these costs, and I said, after he was finished, he said, now, questions. And the students were all very polite, very, very quiet, great kids and all that. They weren't going to ask anything, although I think a few of them knew. And so I just raised my hand. He said, "Yeah, professor." And I said, "Where's your cost of your land?" And he said, "Oh, we already own the land." And I couldn't help myself. I said, "You already own the land. So you don't have to pay for it, do you?" And he began to know where I was going with it. He looked very sad because I said, "In other words, you're not including opportunity cost. That land is a cost. But we already own it." "No, it doesn't matter whether you own it or not. What is the next best thing you could have done with it? You could have sold it. So if you use it for this purpose, it is a cost of this project. Just like if we move you from one project to another, that is a cost of this new project because we have lost you to what you were doing before and what your next best alternative was. Whenever you do anything in this life, there's a cost to it. When you are in this class, you are blowing money because you could be working a job. You could be doing something besides this and making money. When you sleep, when you eat, well, I have to sleep, I have to eat. No question about that, but it's still a cost. Nothing in this life is free. Nothing. Well, you might say, "Well, love is free." No, I was in the Army. Come on. Okay? Understand that cost is everywhere, and we have to recognize, first of all, be realistic about your revenue, but you also have to be realistic about your costs. That's all I have for you tonight. I thank you.